Before we get to today's show, I'd like to invite you to become a part of this show. If you have hiked the John Muir Trail, whether you section hiked it or through hiked it, or if you intend to hike it in the future, then give us a call, 818-925-0106, and please leave a voicemail telling us a little bit about your experience, a memory, a hardship, what you're looking forward to, or how it affected your life positively or even negatively. At the end of this season, I am hoping to collect these voice messages and edit them into an episode focused on the John Muir Trail. So if you would like to potentially have your voicemail appear on the show, call us up, 818-925-0106. Leave us your name, whether that is your real name or your trail name, where you are located, and give us your thoughts within 3 minutes about the John Muir Trail. Thank you ahead of time, and let's get to the show. Everybody, welcome to episode 100 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. You heard that correctly. I said 100. We have officially reached triple digits here at the podcast. It has been almost exactly 5 years since I recorded the very first episode.
Okay. Did you? Awesome.
In Camp 4 in Yosemite.
Okay. Are you going to be able to get close to that?
Mm-hmm.
On May 3rd, 2015.
All right, so I'm already recording.
Sure.
All right.
The series didn't start releasing until September 1st of that year, but it has been 5 years since I started recording these episodes and doing this show, and we are nearly at the end of the fifth season here. We have 4 more episodes left after this before the hiatus between this and season 6. If you had asked me on that day back in May of 2015 if I thought I'd be hitting 100 episodes of this show eventually, I probably would have said no. So here is to 100 episodes and however many more. I want to take a quick moment to let everyone know that episode 97's guest, Ranger Ted, has indeed started releasing his podcast, Wonder Outside with Ranger Ted, and I highly recommend all of you go subscribe to that show and download it now. And I think if you like this show, you will definitely like his show. He has all these segments that make it really enjoyable and a fun interview. So I want to congratulate him for seeing it through and releasing those episodes and starting his own show, and I want all of you to go download it. All right, that's enough housekeeping. Let's get to the meat of this episode. Today, we will be speaking to Taylor Carpenter. She's best known as the founder of Static Climbing. They are a company that makes handmade chalk bags with personality. She and I got together a month or two ago while she was up here in Los Angeles and sat down to talk all about the history of static climbing, what it was like to start a business in your bedroom and watch it grow into something that eventually went international. But we talk about a lot of other things outside of the business in this episode, including her competitive outdoor childhood, her penchant for injury, and I'm not kidding, she has had a lot of injuries, what it has been like dealing with anxiety, which I think is something a lot of you will be able to identify with, and we're going to also discuss a very controversial topic, belt versus carabiner. So let's get this 100th episode started and go talk to Taylor Carpenter.
My name is Taylor Carpenter. Most people know me as the owner of Static Climbing. A lot of people don't really know kind of anything past the last 6 years of me running Static. So in a nutshell, I was born in Newport Beach in Orange County. I'm almost 30, which is exciting, scary and exciting at the same time. I live in San Diego now. I have a house in Oceanside, and we have a little shop in Vista. A lot of people know where Oceanside is. If you know where Camp Pendleton is, then there goes Oceanside, and right behind it is Vista. So even though we have a little warehouse in Vista right now where we make everything, it didn't start there. It actually started in my bedroom when we lived at another house in Oceanside about 6 years ago. And before that, I was living in Mammoth. And that's where I really fell in love with climbing, and really this whole thing kind of started to come together of how Static came to be. And before that, I grew up in Costa Mesa and in Newport Beach. And back in the day, there really wasn't a huge climbing presence. So instead of climbing in gyms, I climbed the door jams of my house, climbed trees, anything I could climb aside from like actual climbs, and gyms was pretty much all I did. I was always in my tree outside my house, as high as I could get.
What kind of tree is it? Set the scene for us. Is it an avocado tree, an apple tree? Does it grow no fruit whatsoever?
Very thin. It was a very thin tree that I broke many pieces off. I don't know exactly which one, but it was probably 15, 20 feet tall. And I definitely gave myself two black eyes when I was probably right around 10. I was climbing a door jamb and my mom was cooking in the kitchen, shimmying up the door jamb, and I got to the top and slipped, cracked both my eyes on the tile.
This is bringing a number of images to my mind. Before we even started the show, you said, oh, I've been hurt so many times, this and that and this and that and the other. And now you're already telling a story about hurting yourself at 10 years old, climbing trees and door jambs. So my question is, were you one of those kids who your parents had to worry about you climbing out of the crib? Do you spend a lot of time in the little door jumper thing? Do you know those things?
Oh, wait, which ones?
Where they like hang it from a door jamb and then they put a kid in it and they can just jump up and down?
I'm sure I did. I don't have any memory.
For adult. Me either. And I want an adult version of that, and I don't know why it doesn't exist.
They don't.
I guess door jams aren't tall enough. Doors aren't tall enough. That's why they don't exist. And because you and I would buy them and no one else. Probably more
Static
people.
Static door jumpers.
We might have found the next product for you. Maybe. But anyway, back to this. So were you a kid that your parents had to worry about you climbing a lot of things and hurting yourself all the time?
Yes. My New Year's resolution almost every year from teenager on was stay out of the ER. I gave my parents such a heart attack every year. It was one thing after another because I was always said I got put in a body that was way too delicate for what I do to it. And my dad and my mom always raised me to just be outdoors. I was never allowed to have video games. I was only allowed to watch a half an hour of TV every day. My dad he's retired now. He was a teacher at my high school. He was a lifeguard, a Newport Beach lifeguard. He just hit 50 years as a Newport Beach seasonal lifeguard. My mom stayed at home and raised us and also worked part-time, and she was always running every day. So naturally, my sister and I were really athletic, and my dad would always push us to be, and my mom, but my dad was always the one adventuring with us, and he would always just push us to be the best we could, compete with everybody, you know, be your best self. So that naturally led to getting hurt a little bit.
So you mentioned a thing that I find intriguing, and I want to delve into it a little further. You mentioned that you were not allowed to play video games. You were not allowed to watch more than half an hour of TV a day, right? Most of us, I would think, these days can watch as much TV as we want growing up and play probably as much or a whole lot more video games than we could. I imagine it's difficult to enforce those regulations, but then also there's that whole issue where it can lead to like strife in the family, right? Because the child wants to do that. But I wonder if because you were part of an outdoor family, and you can tell us about this, and because you were being encouraged in these other activities, if it was easier to enforce those things, like was it difficult for them to keep you from watching TV and playing video games, or were they allowing you to do other things instead that made it unimportant to you to do those things?
I think it was more that. I think it was the fact that if my dad saw us watching TV, he would be like, let's go kick a soccer ball. Let's go skiing for the day. You know, he would do anything he could, and he worked so hard, and my mom worked so hard to give us that adventure outdoor life. So if they saw us watching TV, they wouldn't punish us. They would just say, let's go do something. Let's go to the park. Let's go run around.
It's the difference between negative and positive reinforcement, mm-hmm. right? You can't do this, and I'm not going to provide anything else. It's going to be hard to enforce. It's going to be difficult to do anything. But if you've got that positive reinforcement of what about this instead, then it's a little more natural. So were you a kid who just naturally then wanted to do all those things, which of course led to injuries and various other issues?
Yes, I'm really competitive, and I'm mostly competitive with my own self. I'm my biggest, worst enemy, and so I'm always striving to be the best that I can be. And so in sports, I was naturally drawn to that because it really helped me feed that inner competition. And soccer was my entire life before climbing, before even really snowboarding. That was my other half of my life, was from 5 years old until junior college. I played through junior college. Soccer every single day, 24/7. It was everything to me.
And is soccer a sport you found, or is it a sport mm-hmm. you got encouraged to do? Like, why that instead of tennis or football or baseball or any of the other activities people tend to do in that
age? I tried them all. Not baseball. I think I played t-ball as a little kid, but I was naturally drawn to soccer. My parents, if I remember correctly, kind of exposed me to all of the different sports, and mm-hmm. I naturally just gravitated towards soccer. It was something where a lot of my friends from 5 years old, we kind of started playing together, and we developed those friendships as little kids, and it kind of carried through middle school and high school. So I think that also kept us together, mm-hmm. and I was naturally pretty good at it, and it just helped. I have a ton of anxiety. That's like my darkness in myself, is I struggle from really bad anxiety. And so when I was on the soccer field, it just all went away. And it's the same with climbing, because you're so in the moment. There's no room for anxiety.
And the anxiety you're talking about specifically, how does it manifest? Is it sort of anxiety about your own opinion of yourself, or is it an anxiety about your environment, or all of those things?
It's all the above. It's a lot of, am I doing the best I can? Am I being the best I can? Am I being a good person to the world around me? Am I contributing to the world? Am I being there for all my friends? Just worrying about others and making sure that everyone around me sees me in a light that's like, that's a good person. That's my biggest fear, is not being able to help people when they're down, or the anxiety manifests itself. Are you not doing good enough? Are you not doing a good enough job? And it's funny, because when it goes that deep into being that anxious, it's almost overcompensated to mm-hmm. where, you know, people nowadays are like, how can you be anxious? Like, you have a successful company and a very successful life going right now. And I'm so fearful of not doing well enough, not creating a strong enough product. It's gone overboard in kind of the coolest way. And it's actually helped me relax by finding peace and like finally realizing that everything I've been doing, I'm really happy with, and I feel good enough for myself, which is a pretty comforting thing to know. So my anxiety has really kind of not gone away, but I can manage it a lot better, right? Which is one of the really beautiful things about getting older. People are so scared to get older, mm-hmm. or, you know, their looks are going to go away, or, you know, this or that. But every year I've become happier and happier, because it's less dependent on, oh, what do they think of me? What am I doing good enough? It's more focused on self-love and just understanding that if I'm doing the best I can, then the anxiety kind of disappears, or it just becomes so much more manageable.
I think I've mentioned it on this show before. One of the most freeing moments in my life, and I want to say this was probably somewhere around like 14 or 15, I finally had this realization, because I was one of those people who was always in my head also thinking about what other people were thinking about me, probably some overlap in the sort of anxiety you're talking about as well. For some reason, I don't remember why, but I remember having the realization where it occurred to me that everyone else was experiencing the same thing. So they weren't watching me, judging me. They were worried everyone was watching them, judging them also. And then when I finally realized that, it just felt so freeing, because suddenly I could notice that I don't have to worry about how I'm presenting myself or how people are thinking about me, because they're not.
Right.
They're not thinking about me. They're thinking about themselves.
Right.
Just like I am right now, worried about what they're thinking of me.
Exactly. They're worried, am I presenting myself in the best way? And, you know, am I doing a good enough job to show them that, you know, I'm my best self? So, yeah, it's... We're our own worst enemies a lot of the time.
Well, you mentioned being competitive also, and do you think it derives from that same place?
Definitely. It's the anxiety of, I want to be the best. Mm-hmm. I want to be the best I can be. And always being like, well, you know, you got second. Why didn't you get first? And if you got first, why wasn't the time fast enough?
Right,
so
right.
When I stopped playing soccer, my other half of my life was snowboarding. I was going to Orange Coast College. I had just finished, and I was transferring to Long Beach State, and I found the snowboard team. And being quite an impulsive person and wanting to not let life pass me by, I decided to do one semester at Long Beach State and then do all the rest of my semesters while I lived in Mammoth. The first semester, I did all five classes one day a week from 8 a.m. to 9:45 at night. I drove down from Mammoth at like 3 in the morning, got there by 8 a.m., went 15-minute intervals. At 8:45, I drove to a friend's house in Valencia, spent the night, and was home the next morning. And I did that for an entire semester. I don't think I could do that nowadays.
And for people listening that aren't familiar with the landscape she's talking about, if you were paying attention to the time she posted, you might have been able to do the quick math. But we're talking about 5-hour differences between Mammoth and Valencia. You're traveling 5 hours through multiple counties from Southern California to Central California and back and forth. And did you say you were doing that daily or
once a week?
Once a week,
which
is still a lot.
For an entire semester.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did one semester. I got really creative with all my credits and I did all online classes for one semester because I just loved living in Mammoth. There was something about it. I went up there opening weekend my junior year. I've been there a million times, but it was just something about it. I said, I need to live up here and I need to just explore life. And my final semester, I was about halfway through. I competed in snowboarding for the college circuit with Long Beach State. And I actually was invited to nationals because I had won the division for women's snowboarding. And so I went to nationals and it was a practice day. We did GS and I managed to get fourth in the giant slalom, which is where you just go through a bunch of flags down a really steep hill, essentially. And I placed fourth in that nationally. And then the next day was a practice day for slopestyle. And in Mammoth, we're really lucky because all of the mountains in all of the park in Mammoth is just perfect. Perfect everything. They're just top notch. In Maine, they don't have the luxury of the snow that we have here. It's very icy. And they make the best park that they possibly can. But it's icy. It changes the speed. I didn't have any knowledge of how Maine worked with the snow conditions. So I was hitting a jump and I kind of kept knuckling it, which means you just hit the top of it. You don't clear it correctly. So this person was like, oh, you just need to straight shoot. So no speed checks, straight shoot both of them. And I said, okay. So I was practicing. I straight shot the first one, landed perfectly, landed sweet, went into the next one that I had not hit yet, carried so much speed. As soon as I popped off the lip, I knew something was going to go wrong. I flew so far over the landing, I was like, oh no, I'm gonna bust my knees. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna protect my knees because I had enough time to think in the air. So,
it's amazing how much you can think in just a few seconds.
Your life passes by you so quickly when something's going life-threatening wrong. So I thought, okay, so I hit the edge of my board and kind of kicked it out from under me so that it would like protect my knees. And I sat down. And when you break your back, right around, I did T4, 5, and 6, and I shattered it. And when you break your back, that's kind of the back of your rib cage. So I lost every ounce of breath that I've ever had. And it was like, oh, I popped some ribs. And I was like, my coach was behind me. He picked me up. And I said, I think I broke my ribs and knocked the air out of me. And he grabbed my hand. And I immediately shrieked and realized that I'd broken my back. And out of my ego, I didn't want everybody to see me get carried down in a toboggan. So I kind of threw myself back into shock, rode down the rest of the hill, undid my board. And it wasn't until I stepped down this little 2-inch step that I was like, oh no, something's really wrong. And I went to the little hospital tent in there, the first aid tent. And I was like, I think I broke my back.
And they're like, this is first aid. Yeah. You need something far beyond this.
They looked at me and they're like, No, you didn't. You're probably just...
Because you were walking,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I looked fine. And so I laid on the table. The ambulance came. There was three people to a four-person stretcher and one guy that looked like Santa. So I remember them taking me down three sets of flights of stairs. And I was like in shock still. I got into the ambulance. Two people from my team followed behind me. And I remember calling my parents. And they had given me, was it morphine or, you know, so I'm calling my mom and I was like, I feel fine. They say I broke my back, but I'm okay. Oh, and I was like, I know I said my New Year's resolution was not to go to the ER, but I'm here again.
It's a hard resolution. It's hard to make a resolution that you can't fully control.
Yeah. That was March 6th, 2012. And after the MRIs and everything, they said, yeah, I shattered my T4, 5, and 6. But because I sat straight down, I didn't need surgery. I just needed this fancy TSLO brace for, I think it ended up being 4.5 months. And I was on bed rest for the first 3 weeks. This girl on my team, Jenny, we were always really good friends. But when I broke my back, she did not leave my side. And kind of a funny college story about Long Beach State and San Diego State. We were staying together in a house, and they can throw some crazy parties. There was a party that was going on with like 100 people, I think, and I was upstairs, and a fight broke out so badly that beds were getting turned over.
That's quite a fight.
Yeah, and I'm on bed rest, and if I move the wrong way, I could be paralyzed. The fight comes into my room, and my friend Jenny comes up like this mama bear and goes, "Get out! She is hurt!" And scared everybody so badly. And she sat on the stairs the entire night and made sure nobody came up. And I'm actually going to be in her wedding in April. So shout out to Jenny for keeping me upright and walking. And she just became my best friend ever since that moment.
And I imagine she had to do a lot for your mental state also, because you did mention you're a competitive person, yeah. You're self-conscious, you have anxiety, and being bedridden after hurting yourself is a great time for all of those problems to really manifest themselves in a way you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
So having a person there probably helps a lot.
Yes. So over the course of those 4 months, I really was depressed. I couldn't work out. I couldn't snowboard. I didn't know what to do. So my friend Holly came in. She was from, I can't remember if she had gone back to Australia yet. She was one of my good friends from Mammoth. And she's like, why don't you heal up? And when you get the clearance, come live in Australia for a bit, live in the snowy mountains with me and my family and work in the chalet. So I was like, okay. So I kind of figured when I would be off my TSLO brace, and I booked a one-way ticket there to spend 6 months and live on in the snowy mountains and snowboard in the day and help run their chalet at night. And so I did that, and I graduated from college. I convinced all of my professors to let me write thesis papers once I could concentrate again. Graduated with my bachelor's in psychology, went to Australia, lived there for 6 months and did kind of an endless winter, came back. And that October, I had a job interview at the Westin. And that morning, my roommate and I thought it was a good idea to go skate really quickly at the Volcom Skate Park in Mammoth. And there was a rock in the bowl. And I hit the rock going frontside into the cradle. And I smashed my front teeth out and went to the hospital, got 6 stitches in my lip, lost my front teeth. And my favorite holiday is Halloween. And it was October 12th, 2012. So I went for a month without front teeth so I could be a pirate. I was the evil tooth fairy one night. I was a pirate the other night. It was fantastic.
Hey, at least you're making the best of not having teeth.
Yeah.
And I will let everyone who's listening know that she does have teeth now.
I do.
Yeah, how does that work out? When you knock out your teeth, what do?
They drill your teeth out, what's remaining of them. You get a double root canal. Yeah. And then they did a T-bar and an implant on two teeth. So they're nice and fake now. After that event, that took a couple months to kind of heal up. I had blown out my knee about a year before that, but they didn't know what was wrong. And then I blew it out again, and I went to the hospital again, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong. And finally I said, look, I have insurance. Can you do an MRI, please? Like, something's not right. Because he felt my ACL. He said, I don't feel any rip. And I got the MRI, and he goes, I apologize. You have zero ACL, so there's no way to feel it. I was like, oh, okay. He said, so you'll have to get surgery eventually.
So wait, how do you not have one at all? Like, it ruptured?
Yeah.
Okay.
I blew it to smithereens snowboarding 1 year. it just snapped in half. He said it looked like spaghetti.
And you just weren't aware that it had happened until this moment, or just it was slowly building?
It happened, and I knew that. I remember the day it happened. There's video of it somewhere. It ripped in half, so once the swelling went down, it was fine.
And it probably didn't cause a lot of pain, right?
After 3 days, the swelling was gone.
Because I had not the same problem, but a sort of similar problem where I had fallen off a bicycle a few years ago, caught myself on my left hand, my wrist hurt. I didn't think much of it, and it took me a while to get to a doctor's office. And then they gave me an x-ray, and then they called me back a week later and said, you need to go right now. You have a broken wrist. It's been broken for 3 months. And people will say, oh, you must have a really strong aversion to pain. And it's like, no, it just didn't hurt.
Yeah.
It, like, they would hurt when they did certain things. But so I imagine it was a similar thing. Like,
yeah.
It ruptured. It felt weird. But then it didn't have this constant pain to let you know that there was a real problem.
Right, like splinters and fractures, those remind you all the time what's
right.
going on. But if it's like a clean break or...
Well, right, there's just nerves aren't rubbing
yeah.
against each other and things to say, hey, this hurts, this
yeah.
is bad.
So I was climbing in Bishop right before, it was probably late February of 2013. And I was climbing in Bishop and planned fall. I was like coming down and I had my knee brace on because I knew it was compromised. And I just stepped down. My meniscus flipped, so the padding around your knee, it can go underneath when it's compromised. It can go underneath kind of so you can't move. Well, it flipped. I went into surgery on March 5th, almost a year to the day after my back, and got a brand new ACL and half of my meniscus clipped out. And I was actually supposed to go to, this will all tie together. I was...
Yeah, right now we're just talking about all the ways you've broken your body.
Yeah, I know. They're not over. I was supposed to go to Coachella, my first time ever, and I couldn't. So I was really bummed out. I was getting my hair done. Daryl was doing my hair one day, and she goes, well, you're on crutches. It's been 4 weeks since your knee surgery. You're fine. Why don't you come to Coachella with us? You know, you can stay at Vestal Village, and you can just crutch around. Sure. Sounds great. And I was so excited. And that's actually ended up being the weekend I met my boyfriend, Duncan, it's 7 years later. He's the other half of Static and changed my life completely in the best way possible.
Does that mean you haven't injured yourself since then?
Minus one motorcycle accident. I've been pretty good. He was living in San Diego and I was still living in Mammoth. I started coming down every weekend to see him. And eventually I thought, okay, maybe I'll spend the summer down and then kind of feel it out. In June, I got an internship with the Keep a Breast Foundation. And I don't know if you know much about that. They used to make the I Love Boobies bracelets for breast cancer research. It's giving the youth tools and telling them about how breast cancer can be found and prevented. I learned under Shaney, she's one of my heroes. She is a boss lady to the max. I look up to her in so many ways, and she gave me the tools to start Static. And I just learned under her, and I was the special projects intern. So I helped with anything. And after that summer, I decided to move completely down to San Diego and try it out and really see if this, you know, relationship was going to be something for the long haul, which it totally is. And Duncan introduced me to all of his friends. His friends were some of the most inspirational and motivational people I had ever been surrounded by. And when they say that you are who you're surrounded by, this is the reason that I started Static, because I wanted to do something that gave back to the community, that made a difference, that just did something else, that was something more, and push myself. And that fear of, well, if you try something, what if it doesn't work? All of these people were, you know, they were photographers, web designers, athletes, and things that they go up and down, the ebb and flow. They're not like a stable 9-to-5, but they were all doing it and they were all just pushing forward, and they would bing off each other. One person would have an idea and it may not be related to the other person's career at all, but they would motivate them to maybe do a photo shoot or a photo campaign with an athlete or something. I was so tired of saying the story of, I have my degree, I'm going to do something with it one day, I'm going to do something more. And I was like, stop saying that, just try something. What's the worst that could happen? It fails. You realize why it fails. Try it again. Try something different. The more times you fail, the better you're going to get. You're not going to make those mistakes over and over again. And if you do, eventually you will learn. So I thought, okay, what do I love? I love climbing. Bishop was my playground for a couple years. It was amazing. And I have always wanted to learn how to sew. So I thought, okay, sewing. why don't I learn how to sew? And my birthday was coming up, so my grandparents bought me my first little tiny sewing machine from Joann's. It was like a little $100 sewing machine. And I YouTubed how to wind a bobbin, which is the most basic thing on a sewing machine. How to thread the machine. You know, I knew nothing about pattern making, design, running a business. I figured out how to create a pattern of a chalk bag, and I actually still have that chalk bag in my office because I thought, if this is ever something, it'd be pretty cool to keep this, just in case. And I was so proud of it. It took 3.5 days to make. I had no clue what I was doing. For any seamstresses or seamsters out there, anyone that sews, I didn't understand what a straight stitch even really did, and I thought a zigzag stitch, where it goes back and forth like the top of my chalk bags, I thought that was way more secure because it, you know, multiple contact points that are not straight. I thought that was way more secure. So every single stitch that I did was a zigzag stitch, which takes a lot longer, and I didn't know what a back stitch was. A back stitch is where you go backwards as you're sewing, so it essentially locks the end of the thread from coming undone and unwinding. And so I was hand tying 2 knots after every stitch ended. And
thus 3 days later,
one
chalk bag.
One halfway done chalk bag. The fleece ended up being too short for the inside, so it's actually still open on the inside. The pattern is upside down. It was the most perfect nightmare of a bag, and I was so proud of it. I ran to my climbing gym, which is, at the time, was Vital Carlsbad. I used to help with when they would set and strip the holds. And the manager at the time was Ray. Shout out to Ray. Because I said, look, I made a chalk bag. And he was like, this is cool. Make it a little better. We'll throw some in here. And my competitive spirit was like, oh, this can't put me in the hospital. Okay.
Oh, but it did, didn't it?
No, thankfully. Get me out of the hospital. Finally.
I just thought maybe you'd find a way.
Knock on wood. Not yet that I can think of. It really lit that flame because after a year of constantly being hurt, I was really down on myself. I just thought, I'm not good enough. I'm never good enough. And sure enough, I went home and I just fixated on bag after bag, and it went from 3.5 days to 2 days to 1 day, and every day at the time I was just going to Joann's and buying enough fabric to make that one bag, and I was burning the webbing, you know, on the kitchen countertop, on the stove, and hand trimming the paracord and searing the ends. I mean, everything was just completely ironing with a hand iron, just the fusible webbing on the inside. And I decided to make an Etsy account after putting my first batch of bags in Vital. And I made an Etsy. Nothing sold for like 2 months. And I was dirt biking one day, and I hear this cha-ching. And I was like, what is that?
Is that your phone?
Yeah.
So your phone would make a coin sound whenever you would sell something on Etsy?
It still does. It never gets old. I never have disabled that feature. It is the greatest sound because it just is like saying, I'm proud of you every time it goes off. And to this day, I don't care how, I mean, the more it rings, the more proud I feel. So,
I'm just picturing people being around you and they hear it and they understand why it's happening and they're like, oh, we're going to go buy a bunch of bags right now.
That'd be great.
Just so it makes that noise a bunch of times.
It makes me so happy.
Here's a question. If someone buys 4 bags from you, does it cha-ching once or 4 times? If it's one order.
I'll have to talk this up with Etsy because I think it needs to cha-ching 4 times. But no, it just cha-chings once.
Yeah, they really need to change that feature.
They do. I know. What was funny was I just posted a picture of 3 of the bags I made in one photo. So I was like, what bag does she want? I ended up actually getting in contact with her later on and reached out to her, and I found out, you know, her name and who she was, and I got to talk to her a bit. Just said, you know, thank you for being my first buyer. And she was like, oh, I'll take the left one. So I sent it to her. And I actually replaced it years later. And she's like, well, it still works. I don't need a new one. But I was like, these are way better. Why don't you just keep both? And so that really lit the flame because I've never thought of myself as an artist. I was always told, like, you're the athlete. You know, you're not an artist. You can't draw. And so I always kind of felt ashamed of my artistic side. And I thought, well, I'm not an artist. I don't know how to draw. I'm a stick figure drawer at best. So this really lit a flame of being like, you're an artist, you can do this. And it just, every waking moment, 12 hours a day, I would go and bartend, and I was a server and a bartender at the time at a brewery that I helped open up. And then later on, before I went full-time as a static at a sushi restaurant, I would put every waking hour into static. And I actually came up with the name static. I was climbing at Vital one day and I had Googled everything, trying to figure out what's a good name. And I was climbing one day and my friend, also named Taylor, he's like, oh, just do this move real static and you can get it. And I was like, static? Huh, what do you think? And I just walked around and that was it. I was like, I love static climbing. I love dynamic climbing, but I am so not good at it.
Well, I mean, static, you know, gives the impression, and for people listening that don't understand the difference, static climbing is kind of like more precise movement that doesn't involve, say, dynamic moves like leaping or lunging for something. It's usually like more precise, more technical movement. So to do something statically sometimes requires better technique than otherwise. So yeah. In some ways it makes a lot of sense to name the company that.
Yeah, it's a very focused, driven, concentrated movement and very delicate, but very tough. So I came home and I was like, Duncan's my boyfriend. I was like, Duncan, static. That's it. And he was a very, very amazing graphic designer. He has since retired and come on full time as the other half of Static. But at the time he was, I mean, I would say one of the best of the graphic designers in the business. And one night he came up to me and he said, look, I made you a logo. I believe in you. And it was the logo we still use today. And it was funny because at first I said, could you add some flowers to it? And he said, I think you're going to like just the mountain and the triangle. I said, okay. Him believing in me and my friends being so stoked on me trying something, I just took every $5 that Static made, I invested 100% of it back into the company. And to this day, I have built this company based on its own dollar. The company is debt-free. Duncan and I own 100% of it. And it is not the easy road to take, but for any entrepreneurs out there, I highly recommend that journey because at the end of the day, I am my own boss and I really don't have to answer to anybody else. Whereas if you have an investor, it might be necessary and it might be a wonderful partnership. But if you have the ability to take the income and have a second job at the same time, nothing beats the satisfaction of me being able to say that my company is my baby, that Duncan and I can collab together and nobody can say, well, the numbers see this, or, you know, this is what marketing looks better. It's like I can develop my whole soul and my heart into the company. And at the end of the day, it's like it shows in the products, it shows in just kind of everything. And it's not the easiest road. I can't tell you how many times I've cried at my sewing machine and how many times I thought I can't do this, how many times it just seemed like too much. Like when I decided to go full time was probably 2 years into the company, and I've never missed a day of work. I'm not late. Both jobs were very important to me. And I had my very first no call, no show, which means in the serving world, you didn't show up for your shift and you didn't call saying you weren't going to be there because I forgot I had to work. And I was so mortified. It was the day that it clicked that I need to jump and try. And if I fail, I fail. But if I don't, this could be something really amazing. And so I did it. And my manager was so supportive of me because he knew. And he's like, don't worry about coming in. Like, go. Do it. Static started in the bedroom of our Oceanside home. We moved to another Oceanside home where it had its own room. And then we moved into the wall climbing gym, which is in Vista. It was owned at the time by my friends Randy and Matt. And they gave us their top floor. There was like a little tiny, probably 16 by 16 room. And the funny thing was, it was actually missing one of the walls. So when climbers would top out, they couldn't climb over, but when they would top out, their hands would would hit right where my sewing machine was, and I had to dust off everything in the day because there was no wall, and it was just a chalk monster. And so those were some of the coolest times. We had the whole production line going in those. It was me, Duncan, and then at the time I had, Kate was my first seamstress in the very beginning, then it was Elise, and they were amazing. Elise actually taught me how to backstitch and taught me that a straight stitch was what you do. She was a legitimate seamstress and taught me so much about how I actually sew today. Then Justin came along. Justin really helped me refine the speed and the timing and really learning how to kind of speed up production with such a small crew. I've lost all of my seamstresses to their partners moving to another state. So I'm very honored that nobody ever really wanted to leave. And I still keep in contact with all of them. And they're very, very close to me. And when Justin left, Lauren came into our life, and Lauren was with us for 2.5 years, and Lauren was there right when REI found us. I had my Etsy going, we were in a bunch of gyms, and we had our website going, and REI emailed me, and they said, hey, we like your chalk bags, we saw you on Etsy, would you be willing to work with us? I was like, this is not a real email. REI doesn't reach out to right. you.
How often do you just get an REI email? Or,
yeah. I thought it was spam. I was like, there's no way. And I dropped my phone. I was just like, what? Ended up being real. And shout out to Pam for changing all of our lives.
Do you get a cha-ching every time REI sells one of your talk bags?
No, but every Monday night, orders come in, their weekly orders. So every Monday night, we sit by the computer and we wait for the orders to come in. And it's just like a family event. Like Duncan and I, we sit down, we eat dinner, and we wait for the orders just patiently. And it's so exciting because the satisfaction of that is similar to the cha-ching because of like REI is the dream. And for anyone that loves REI on the outside, you know, that goes in and thinks it's amazing, the back end and the behind the scenes is even more amazing. And I wish people could see more of that. Because not only did they take me from a teeny, teeny, tiny company, you know, at the time it was like, you know, 15 bags was a lot, or 40 in a day was like, oh, I need to go to bed. They said, you know, well, why don't we start with, you know, 30 stores? And then why don't we, as soon as you're ready, if they sell well, you know, we'll add more and we'll let you grow. We'll let you grow at your own pace. Well, the bags, they had a target for a month. And they hit that target within the first like week and a half. And they said, your bags are doing great. We really want you on board. So over the course of a couple months, I got my production going. My two industrial machines that are with me now came into my life. And Lauren and I learned how to really speed up production. And over the course of a couple of months, they said, are you ready? And I said, yes. So they go, all right, let's go to half doors. So half of the 160 stores. And as soon as we got streamlined with that, they said, how are you doing? Good? Ready? Okay. Let's go to all doors. And so about a year in, they said, are you ready? Let's do it. All doors. I said, yes. Granted, every time we added that many stores, there were so many hours of me crying at my sewing machine trying to get all of these chalk bags ready. But I didn't want to disappoint them because they had given us the opportunity of a lifetime. And at that point when REI happened, Duncan came on full time and kind of retired from graphic design because I just couldn't do it on my own. Duncan created all of the social media, all of the graphic design work, the hang tags, and then he ended up prepping all of the materials for us. So the fleece, the interfacing, steaming the bags, cutting them, prepping them, cutting the webbing. I mean, you name it. Every part of the chalk bag and the bucket is prepped in our warehouse. And he took over all of that and all of the shipping. And I sewed full-time, Lauren sewed full-time. And together we made all doors happen. And over the last year, we've been able to grow into, I think, 6 or 7 different countries now. We're in Singapore, Tokyo, Sweden, the UK, Spain, Netherlands, Canada, Australia. I mean, it's incredible.
And is that REI that's helping make that global reach happen, or is that outside of REI channels?
It's outside of REI channels, but I believe that once REI happened,
right, it just you became more visible in general, right?
Outside Magazine in 2019 for their Winter Buyer's Guide featured the bucket as the bucket of the year. And that's actually where a couple different international brands found us. It's been absolutely unreal and so life-changing that REI gave us the ability. They were so nice. And I would go meet up at headquarters and they were just like, how are you? Are you doing good? What can we do to help? You know, they helped me every second of the way. And like for a giant, massive company to just hold your hand, because you hear, oh, a giant company's just going to rip you off.
Right, right.
And it's scary too. You know, the man, they're nothing like that. They're so about each individual product in there, and they care so much about sustainability and where your product line trends back to and how it's made and fair trade, and just such an A+ company. and I'm honored to be in their store.
So we've transitioned into kind of telling the story of how Static came to be. But for those people who are listening who maybe aren't super familiar or familiar at all with Static, why don't you explain specifically what Static Climbing is as a company, not the term.
That's very true.
And how it differs from other companies that do a similar thing.
I make handmade chalk bags. That was what it started out as. Most of the chalk bags at the time were a lot smaller and a lot narrower. And when I was climbing at Vital, I asked the setters that were way more experienced than I was, and I said, what would you look for in a chalk bag if I were to make one? And they said, oh, wider, taller for my hand, so I don't have to think when I chalk up about my hand missing the chalk bag. Textiles. No one really used at the time. No one really used unique textiles, patterns, and they were all very generic. No one focused on them. So I thought, okay, I could bring a new spin to a chalk bag. So I made it taller, and I made it a little deeper. And using those different textiles, I wanted your chalk bag to tell your story, to express who you are. There's not a lot of climbing gear when you climb. I mean, if you have a trad rock, yes. But, you know, in general, there's not much that can express who you are as a climber. And a chalk bag can really do that. I designed the chalk bag, and then the bucket came along about a year and a half later. And I took all my favorite parts of all my favorite buckets, and I designed the bucket to be sturdy so that if you just throw it down, it has such a wide base, it's really hard to tip over. And that was my big thing with a bucket. And it's fleece lined. I'm a big texture person. And so the anti-pill fleece is very soft on your hands. And if you ask anyone that's seen me out climbing, I am famous for not having chalk in my chalk bag. And the fleece in the chalk absorbs some of the chalk. So I really do that on purpose. And the two belts are perfectly separated so that when you're overhung or you've got the knee bar and you really need to like reach for that chalk in a pinch, that the chalk bag doesn't twist. It cinches closed really well. And one of my favorite parts about my bags is the chalk bags, everything that I sew has a lifetime warranty on it because I really look up to Patagonia, North Face. They'll fix anything. And if you have a problem, they want it to be a lifetime bag so there's less waste in the world. So having the chalk bag or anything I sew have a lifetime warranty, A, I back my stitching 100%, but everything is handmade, so if something were to pop or anything, I'll fix it or replace it for you. And it's funny because I feel like that's a growing trend, and I really love that, that companies nowadays are not just focused on give them the cheapest price and, or product and let them get another one. I want you to have it for life, and the way that I could have more customers is mostly repeat customers are, oh, you came out with a new pattern. I have to get that pattern. I have friends that have original bags that I cannot give new ones to. I say, can I please update your bag? You're repping Static, and this is so janky. And they said, it's gangster, and it still works. So, no. I'm very proud of the products that we all sew, all the people that helped get Static to where it's at. And Lauren ended up moving to be with her boyfriend. She's going to come back. I know she will. I text her and she said, you know, leaving California was all right, but I miss working with you the most. And that is probably the coolest compliment that I've ever heard, because the way that I run the company that Duncan and I try to employ everybody is with them in mind first. I'd rather take on more sewing if they're having a bad day or if they want to go surf. Like, you know, Lauren, she's like, oh, surf's up. I'm going to go surf. I'll come back. Or I'm going to go teach a yoga class and come back. I wanted them to have their own schedule. Put the responsibility of, look, I need this many bags done by today or by the end of the week. You come in when you want. Your machine's there. And if you're not having a good day or you need, you know, mental health day, just let me know. You're more important. If you want to go travel, let me know. And we'd call it front loading. So they'd say, hey, can I front load this week? I really want to go climb next week. So they would do double the work in 1 week. And that's always been really important. And I hope to build up to where I can kind of like how I think Prana does this. I'm pretty sure Prana does this. They give their team an hour of paid time off to go to be outdoors. I really hope to do something like that. When Lauren left, Marie came into the picture, and Marie is so sweet and so kind. And she is my steady warrior of a seamstress. She is so reliable, and so she bakes me cookies and cheesecake, and she's amazing.
Just to bring up something, because you were mentioning potentially Prana and you mentioned Patagonia earlier, and basically this theory behind how to manage your office brings to mind a book that perhaps you've already read or you're familiar with, the Yvonne Chouinard, Let Your People Go Surfing.
Yes.
Is that one of the references for you and how you run your business?
Absolutely. 100%. Because at the end of the day, you should not hate going to work. And I told everybody that if you're not happy to come to work, you let me know and we'll figure out how to make it so that you want to come here. And I've had rock stars of people that have worked with me. You know, I don't ever want to feel like the boss. I want to feel like a leader, but I'm not over you. I will stay till midnight and sew if you're having a hard day. The most recent rock star to come onto our team is Zane. She is 20, and I feel like she's 20 going on 40 with how wise and how mature and how talented of a seamstress she is. She's incredible. And she's going to go so far in life. And I'm so honored to have her on the team right now, too. Because I'll show her a pattern. I'll show her a stitch. She knows it. Within 2 seconds, she's like, oh, like this? Okay. I mean, just incredible. So Duncan and I are really lucky to have the team that we do. By giving your team that kind of freedom to be able to make their own schedules and really work with their lives, I have some of the most reliable and loving environment and crew that I could have ever asked for.
Yeah, the thing with that sort of approach too is there's a bit of self-selection that'll happen. Those people who need a more structured environment, they won't last. Everyone will catch on relatively quickly and then they'll leave and you move on to the other person. But for those people who can work, in a sense, it is more likely to empower them. As much as it feels like maybe to some people who've worked in traditional sort of environments, that you're allowing people to be irresponsible, you're actually offsetting responsibility onto them and making them feel more responsible because they do know I'm responsible for this happening. And this is my quota, or however you want to look at it, that I need to meet. And I need to find the way to make that happen. And I need to manage that instead of someone else babysitting me and giving me rules and regulations to abide by.
Totally. It gives them the power. They're a part of the team. I always try to remind them of that. And we just listen to podcasts all day long, podcasts, music, we'll have family lunches. And we just sew. And that's, I think, shows in the quality of the chalk bags and the buckets and the mini duffels. And, you know, our whole team is four. And we do thousands of bags a month.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you because the team was originally you. And then it was you and Duncan. And so now it has grown to four people. Do you foresee it getting larger than that? Or does that seem like a sustainable number of people? Like, is there a point where you're afraid to have the company reach because then you can't assure that it's maintaining the quality that you want? Or do you feel like you could get so much larger before that's a concern?
I feel like we can grow so much larger before that's a concern because we've had the time to really implement the office to be high functioning. I mean, to be able to cater to REI, all these countries, our retail, over 50 gyms with four people. If we added five employees, six team members, I mean, we could double. With three seamstresses, we can do that. So with six, we could double. I mean, that's a lot of chalk bags and buckets and duffels. So I've really worked hard to create an atmosphere where we can grow with such a small team. And I think part of it is because we manufacture everything in-house, it's really easy to keep it small because everything is cut in-house. So I'm not relying on, oh, is this cut yet? Is this made yet? You know, is this order going to be wrong? You know, if one bag doesn't turn out, we can stop the production right away. And with all of our waste, it actually goes to a pretty interesting spot. We have archery targets in our backyard where we like to practice archery on our free time. So all of the extra remnants of the side fleece or the side anything, little fusible webbing, anything that can't be turned into something, we actually stuff together and make archery targets out of. So we have very little waste. And all of the fabrics, the waxed canvas is from a 7th generation family-owned company. I talk to these cute ladies on the phone every time I order. I ask them about Christmas and holidays, and they tell me all about their adventures. I love them so much. We order the fabric through them, so it's family-owned since the 1800s. A 7th generation, I mean, long time. And then the artist series, we collaborate with different artists. Right now we're working with Stevie Lewis and Crispin Chetler, Sky Walker, and Craig Motterlock. And 10% of each of those chalk bag sales goes back to each of the artists. And those fabrics are printed with eco-friendly dyes. And it's actually, we order the fabric from a company on the East Coast that used to be a much smaller, intimate company, and I think it's actually grown, which is so cool, but it's still American printed, eco-friendly dyes. And the traveler blankets are actually made from recycled clothes down in Mexico. And this family in Mexico makes the blankets and they drive them up to where I live in Oceanside. And there's a local store in Oceanside, a family-run store where I buy the blankets from, as well as the Pendleton wool. And so I'm supporting local. I'm paying more for it, but it means a lot to me to try to source as locally as possible and support these, you know, little communities near me. The Pendleton wool is, for those of you that don't know Pendleton, it's made up in Oregon, sustainable wool. They've been around forever, and they're a very, very intimate company, but huge. And we have the ability to use their fabric to make sustainable wool chalk bags as well. So each of the fabrics that we use and each of the textiles is really important to, like, try to source the story. And we want the whole chalk bag to have a story, because once you get it, the story continues. And that's really important.
So I want to commend you for having the foresight to begin with a chalk bag so you could learn to sew on something that isn't necessary for safety. For instance, I'm glad you didn't start with harnesses or something.
That was the reasoning. I thought, okay, a chalk bag can't kill people.
Right. But I do know you now. You've mentioned you offer duffels. Mm-hmm. You make chalk buckets. Mm-hmm. When people think of Static Climbing, do you want them to think of you as a chalk bag company, or do you want them to think of you as a different type of company? Do you have the plans to try to grow into more products, or do you want to keep it with that core set of products?
I'd like to focus always on chalk bags. And as long as Duncan and I own the company, I will not source them out. They will stay in-house with my team and supporting the local seamstresses in the world and seamsters in the world. So that's 100% important to me. I do want to get into backpacks and more of the adventure packs. I think that would be awesome once I'm not sewing 17 hours a day. But thanks to my rock stars that are in training, hopefully that will come to play very soon, and I can really start focusing on duffel bags and rope bags and different types of bags. Because over the last 6 years since I've started Static, I would definitely say I've put in the 10,000 plus hours. And
oh, so you're an expert, is what
almost,
you're saying.
Almost. There's always something to learn, but those machines, I can listen to them. They talk to me. And my seamstresses are starting to hear them talk to them. And it'll be like, oh, you hear that tick, tick, tick. Okay, the needle probably needs to be replaced. Oh, it sounds, you know, the thread broke on the top. Oh, it's probably a bobbin issue. And I can listen to the machine and tell when it's running good, or tell if something's wrong with it. I can fix every part of the machine now. Whereas before, I was running to the sewing machine store, and Mario, shout out to Mario for training me over all of these years. He didn't have to. And I would come in and he would show me how to fix it at the sewing machine store down the street from my house that sold me all of these machines. And I remember one of my machines, my industrial machines, broke. And I called Mario and I said, look, I can't take this into you. It's huge. It's massive. I don't know what to do. And he came out and he would not let me pay him. I had to sneak it in a card, a thank you card later. And he said, you know, you're my friend. This is what friends do. I just was like, oh my God, he's so kind. He would take time out of his day any day to help me and teach me. He goes, I want to teach you so you can fix your machines. So because of that, I can listen to my sewing machines, and if they're fussy, I can tune them myself now. I never thought going from YouTubing how to wind a bobbin to like being able to listen to something going wrong with the tension discs or something is pretty awesome.
And how many years did you say it's been since that YouTube video?
Six in April.
So 6 years.
Six in April.
So Static is climbing gear specifically.
Yes.
You mentioned backpacks. Do you intend to always be for climbers? So climbing backpacks, you're not interested in backpacking backpacks or anything in that way? Maybe.
Okay. Maybe. I always want to be climbing focused, mm-hmm. but I think to narrow your mindset on just one thing and only have it be one thing is silly. I think there's always room, if you're inspired to learn and delve into the backpacking world, I think do it. What's the worst that could happen? It doesn't work. And then you're like, okay, that didn't work. And so anyone that's scared to start a company, or anyone that thinks, oh, I can't do it, or I don't have the time, don't make the excuse. Just little tiny bits, because as soon, give it 5 minutes. Work on a plan. Work on where you're going to get your material for whatever you want to do. 5 minutes and put it away. You have 5 minutes. And then eventually you'll be like, well, I'll just spend 10 minutes on it, and then 20. And then now it's, you know, 7 a.m. to midnight. Duncan and I'll cook dinner. We'll be watching, you know, a movie, going to sleep, and I'll be like, did you order that webbing? You know, it's zero turnoff. Owning a business, some people see, oh, you must have it so easy. Any entrepreneur, you trade a 40-hour work week for a 100-hour work week, and it never turns off. It's all you think about.
Which is why it's important that you do something you care about instead of something you hate doing.
Exactly. And my mom always said, I don't care what you do, you be the best damn person that you can be in that job. You be the best you can be. And I always took that to heart. So it's like, it's contagious, but the hardest part is that first step and that fear. And there's times when I'm like, I'm not doing well enough. I'm failing at life. I'm failing at this. I'm not running the business to the best of my ability. And it goes up and down. It's not just like, oh, I'm on the other end of the rainbow. Everything's sunshine.
And the thing, maybe secret, maybe not, is that never goes away.
Never.
Jeff Bezos is thinking the same thing, and he is one of the wealthiest people on the planet, owning Amazon. I'm sure you can name anyone who runs a business that looks however successful you think it is, and they are going to still have those moments. I'm also a business owner, so the thing I realized at some point in life is no matter how big any business is, it's always so many failures away from going out of business.
Always.
And that's just something you end up having to accept, come to terms with, and deal with.
It's the drive. It's the drive because you never know where the next step is. Could be off a cliff. You don't know. So it lights that fire of always wanting to try to push it further and refine the design and make this tiny little tweak in the production line. To this day, last week, we've made thousands and thousands of chalk bags. And last week, we came up with a little fix to tweak something to make it easier to sew a certain stage. Who would have thought? So it's just never being content. Always saying, what's next? What's next? And that's every entrepreneur's drive. I'm sure you can relate to that.
You make chalk bags largely. And so I think I'd be remiss to not ask this next question, which is highly controversial. For you personally, do you put your chalk bag on a belt or do you clip it to your harness?
I go back and forth. It really depends.
All right, come on. It sounds like you're being wishy-washy. Tell us your reasoning.
Mostly belt, because I really like moving my body and kind of like contorting it. My arms are actually very double jointed. So when I lock out on something, like I can show you, when I lock out on something, it twists overly extensive. And so for me, having my chalk bag on a belt, it can move where I'm moving. So if I'm twisted sideways, you know, I can reach, the chalk bag will kind of float to me better. So mostly belt.
I'm a belt.
Are you?
I can't. People are welcome to write in, call in, whatever, and change my mind. But I cannot think of a single benefit that outweighs all the benefits of a belt.
Yeah. It's just so stable in one spot.
So if this hurts your business, now that you've committed to being a belt person, I apologize beforehand, but I feel like it's something we just have to talk about.
It's partially why I sell the belt separately. People always ask, why doesn't it come with a belt? Because there are people that don't wish to have a belt, and I don't want them to just throw it away or not need it. So if I can separate the cost and you can choose to be a belt or a carabiner.
That's right, and we'll respect you either way.
Exactly.
So what I want you to do now is tell everyone who's listening who is suddenly very interested in static climbing how they can keep up with what static climbing does, purchase your goods, see what's in the future, and just follow the company in general. What should they do online or otherwise to keep up with the company?
They can follow Everything is Static Climbing, so S-T-A-T-I-C. C-L-I-M-B-I-N-G. Some people think, because, I mean, it makes sense. It could be a clever marketing to, like, drop one of the C's, you know, because there's two C's.
Right, right, right.
So it's static climbing. But the website is www.staticclimbing.com. The Etsy is /staticclimbing. And if you go on REI, it's, static climbing, and Google. And Instagram.
Okay. And Facebook also, or no?
Facebook definitely too. I focus more on Instagram and then I auto upload to Facebook, and I do check Facebook. If anyone directly wants to get a hold of me, I run all of the social media platforms myself. So a direct message works, but the best way is to email taylor@staticclimbing.com, and I will get back to you within a day. I try to do it immediately. The email goes right to my phone. Since I've been sewing about 17 hours a day, I've been a little behind. So behind for me is a day response rate. But if you have any questions, you have any concerns, you can reach out to me directly. It's a very close link from customer to owner. And if you have any questions, concerns, or even like happy comments, I really love getting happy emails. You can reach out to me. The info@staticclimbing.com also goes to my phone. So fear not.
And if you want to make her extremely happy, go buy anything, no matter how small, from the website. So she gets a cha-ching sound delivered to her phone. So what about you personally? If people are interested in keeping up with you, is that a thing that people are able to do?
Following how I grew up, my childhood, I am not very good with social media in a sense of I really try to be present and focused. I do have an Instagram that I rarely post on, but sometimes I'll try to get more into it. But Taylor J, so it's TAYYLOR_J. It's mostly pictures of my dog. It wouldn't be a podcast if I didn't mention my golden doodle. For all you dog lovers out there, there is a massive, we call him a little pony, big old 6-year-old golden doodle named Dakota that has been with Static since day one.
I guess apparently nearby parrots or cats or something are frightened by the sound of this animal.
He is the shop dog. He is always covered in thread, and he makes sure that the UPS man and the FedEx and the mail person always get their hugs and kisses. He runs into the UPS truck because he's such good homies with the guy. He's the light of mine and Duncan's life. Wouldn't be the same without him, and the shop wouldn't be the same. He loves going underneath our sewing machines and stepping on the pedal. So as soon as it's like a shark. As soon as we see him go around the sewing machine, we turn the machine off, and then he pokes through and sticks his head in your lap and then wags his tail and needs pets.
If people want to receive a chalk bag that has been licked by the by the dog, is that an option that they can choose on checkout?
I mean, if they directly, I can ask him to give it kisses. But that is actually, it reminded me of something I totally spaced on. Each chalk bag is scented with local organic lavender. Just one little drop in the bag. And a company that's about 40 minutes from where we sew the chalk bags. It's this woman that owns a lavender field, and it's a USDA organic ice cream.
Ice cream does not come included with your chalk bag, but it is available in this neighborhood in Bell where we are right now.
But yes, each chalk bag is scented with one drop of organic local lavender. So I like, it's another way I can support a local female entrepreneur.
So what I always do at the very end of the show is I ask you if there is a final thought that you want to leave everyone with that has anything to do with what we've talked about so far, or maybe something we haven't talked about at all.
Life has its ups and downs. I've been going through a lot of thinking about this. I've had a lot of people, including one of my childhood best friends, pass away recently in the last couple of years. And life is so short. So if you have an idea, if you have a fear of an idea, just try it. Try it and fail. Try it and succeed. Try it, fail, and then succeed. It's not all about the ups. It's when you're in your darkest moment is really how you appreciate all of the beauty in life. To anyone out there that's like having a hard time or in a dark place, you know, we all go through that, and there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It does get better, and it's just sometimes focusing. Static has gotten me through a lot of dark times, you know, with close ones I love passing away. So sometimes focusing on that idea when you're in your darkest place can help pop you out of it. When you focus on that, a lot of the times people around you are inspired, and maybe they're having a really hard time, and maybe that inspires them to pop out of their, you know, dark place. Or if they're in a really good place, they're so much more jazzed to take their project to the next level or whatever they're working on, or maybe just being nicer in the community. I'm so thankful for every friend and person and family, and, you know, including you. Like, I'm so thankful for being able to be on this podcast. It it's so cool.
Well, I hope it lives up to your expectations.
Sure.
Well, thank you very much for coming and sitting in this yard with me and Belle and talking to all of these people about your life experiences and your business.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you for having me at Long Beach, my home, my alma mater for college. Go Dirtbags. That's funny. Our college is the Long Beach Dirtbags.
Is that...
That's
true?
For real.
No kidding.
Yeah. So, thank you.
Thank you. Static Climbing is working to do their part during this pandemic, and they are currently making tons of face masks. And not only are they making these face masks available for purchase, but they are donating one mask for every mask sold to either a hospital or someone in need. So if you are in need of a face mask or you would like to help others who need them get a hold of them, then head to Static Climbing and help them make that possible. And this is, of course, that point of the show where I tell all of you to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 100 with Taylor Carpenter. There you will find photographs and links to everything we talked about in today's show. And since you are already going to be on the internet perusing the wares of Static Climbing, then won't you do us a favor here at the show? Why don't you send us an email, go@butcherbirdstudios.com. Let us know what you think about this or any of the past previous 99 episodes. Or if you hate email and you'd rather get in touch with us some other way, you can text us or leave us a 3-minute voicemail at 818-925-0106. And if you've been listening to this show, you should know this part right now. Please head to your podcast purveyor of choice, subscribe, rate, review the show, and share it with someone you adore. This episode of the Go Get Outside podcast was produced, recorded, and edited by me, your host, Jason Milligan. Additional help was provided by Griffin Davis, and as always, it has been brought to you by Butcher Bird Studios. Next time on the show, come back May 16th when we are on the other side of 100 episodes and listen to John Gage. He is the founder of the Appalachian Gear Company, and this episode is going to delve into manufacturing and the textile industry. So for all you gearheads, this will be a great episode to check in for. But he is also going to tell us all about the road to 100% alpaca goods. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, then come back May 16th and find out more. Thanks again to everyone who has come aboard during these 100 episodes or come aboard for this 100th episode. So come back May 16th. John Gage. See you then. Ooh.